Thank you, Alan, and good morning. It's nice to be here, and I appreciate being invited. And I wanted to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about wetlands and agricultural landscapes. The title is what I was thinking 6 or 8 months ago when Alan asked me about doing this talk. In actually putting the talk together, the focus has changed a little bit, as you'll see. But in general, I'll address natural ecosystem processes and their environmental benefits. Mostly focusing on ARS research, I am the national program leader for ARS's Water Availability and Watershed Management Program, and so I wanted to highlight some of the things that we do in ARS focused on wetland systems. So there are a number of different types of wetlands that you might find in agricultural landscapes, and this talk, I'm not sure what the talks to come will be like, but this talk is going to be a little bit different from what you've heard this morning, because we're kind of focusing away from the production systems per se and talking about other features on the landscape but the benefits they provide. So in agricultural landscapes, you've got natural wetlands that provide various ecosystem services, including water quality improvement, carbon storage, as well as wildlife habitat, et cetera. In many landscapes, these natural wetlands have been reduced by agriculture and by other forces, often for the conversion of wetlands to croplands. So in many agricultural landscapes, we also find what we call, what we've come to call prior converted croplands, which are former wetlands that are now croplands that could be converted back to wetlands. And the figure in the bottom figure there shows you an example of that. And it highlights a very important feature, the fact that these former wetlands as part of now agricultural fields often exhibit wetland hydrology periodically, not necessarily every year, but in at least in some years. In addition, in agricultural landscapes, you'll often find restored wetlands, croplands that have been restored to some form of wetland system, not necessarily always the type of wetland that was there before. Sometimes it's very difficult to restore that type of wetland in an agricultural landscape. But the attempt is to try to bring back or increase the wetland ecosystem services. These attempts, sometimes they're successful, sometimes they're not so successful. And then finally, you'll also find in many agricultural landscapes constructed wetlands that are used specifically for a purpose, for water quality improvement, for example. They're not really meant to replicate natural wetlands. There are attempts to basically engineer treatment systems, often for water quality, that capitalize on what we know about wetland ecology and wetland biogeochemistry to perform a specific function for agriculture. But they often provide benefits in addition to those water quality functions for which they were constructed. So what I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to give you a couple of quick examples of some of the past research on wetlands and agricultural landscapes that we've done in ARS. I'm going to talk about two current ongoing case studies that are really kind of where we are, and then I'm going to talk about a third study that is kind of where I see this discussion and this research and the policy implications going, and finally try to sum it all up, and I'm hopefully going to do that in another 24 minutes or 21 minutes or whatever. So one of the earliest looks at riparian ecosystem services in ARS was by our watershed research group in Tifton, Georgia, using the Little River Experimental Watershed. They've done a lot of work on riparian wetlands, riparian buffers, forested wetlands, and agricultural landscapes, and the ecosystem services that they provide, particularly with respect to water quality improvement. They've been publishing on this at least since the 1980s, if not before, and Richard Lorenz is one person whose name has been continually associated with this work over the years. And if you look at this slide, for example, it shows you some of the results. These are from modeling efforts, but again, of course, based on based on data that's been collected in the field and using the riparian ecosystem management model, which was developed at this location, to show that if you that existing buffers help to reduce sediment and phosphorus about 70%. Nitrogen, the reduction is not quite so good, probably because of the form of nitrogen nitrate, which is very mobile. The reductions of sediment and phosphorus together are probably indicative of the fact that the phosphorus and the sediment may be traveling together, phosphorus absorbed to the sediment particles. You can get about another 5% increase in retention of sediment, nitrogen, and phosphorus across the board if you can, in the landscape, if you can keep have all buffers extend to at least 14 meters in area. Here's another example from a different part of the country, from Ohio, where constructed wetlands were used as part of a wetland reservoir sub-irrigation system. This is basically a system. Let's see, I guess I can I point with this? You use a wetland to basically receive subsurface drainage and surface runoff from a cropland, and that supports wetland ecosystem processes, and some nutrient removal occurs there. And then excess water is transferred to a reservoir still carrying nitrate and potentially other chemicals, and that water is used to sub-irrigate the cropland during drier periods, providing both a water and a nutrient benefit. These types of systems have been shown to have a general increase of about 25% in productivity. They also provide habitat for wetland plant and animal species in the reservoir systems, and they show significant reductions in the overall losses of nitrate and other potential agricultural pollutants on the landscape. So these two examples, they're very sort of site-specific, location-specific, looking at specific wetland types and specific landscapes. Now, I want to move now to things that have more of a regional or a watershed or landscape perspective. And the first is a wetland project that ARS has been associated with in the Mid-Atlantic region. It's part of the SEEP, or Conservation Effects Assessment Project, Wetland Studies. And you can see there are a host of characters here. My name is first on this list only because I'm giving the talk. It's the other people who've done the majority of the heavy lifting here. And it's a collaboration among a number of federal agencies, state agencies, universities, et cetera. It's focused on wetlands in the Mid-Atlantic region, and there's a great diversity of wetlands in that region, and so basically the focus was reduced to the coastal plain extending from New Jersey to the North Carolina-South Carolina border. And within that region, there were two focus areas that were demarcated, the Delmarva Peninsula and sort of the southeastern Virginia, northern North Carolina coastal plain. And it uses a model of, within each location, starting with a restored wetland, which was identified through NRCS records, where wetland restoration had been supported through NRCS conservation practices, and then locating as close as possible within that same landscape a natural wetland and an area of wetland that was converted to cropland that is still in cropland. And so this basically is what came to be called in this study an alteration gradient, going from prior converted cropland to restored wetland to natural vegetation, or vice versa, depending on how you wanted to look at it. The study basically built upon the Chop Tank Watershed Study, which was originally an NRCS special emphasis SEEP watershed for the croplands watershed research. It was later taken over by ARS, and one of the hallmarks of this overall project is the strong use of technology, remote sensing, radar-based hydrology characterizations, again, starting in the Chop Tank watershed. And what this allowed in this landscape was a very accurate quantification of wetland hydroperiod, seasonally, interannually, and spatially. And I could show you, I could do a whole talk on this, or Megan Lang could do a better talk on it. I could show you hundreds of slides, but the bottom line is that if you look at the landscape of, and this is particularly for the Delmarva Peninsula, if you look at the landscape and note that the elevation here is exaggerated by about 20-fold, so it's a very flat coastal plain landscape. But using these LIDAR determinations of hydroperiod, you can find very wet areas in the lighter blue that, this is over a two-year period, that were wet in both years, so flooded during both years. You can see areas that were flooded only in an average year but not in a drier year, and then the yellow color are areas that were never flooded. And you're able to pick this up. You could do it over the course of a season. You can do it year to year, and you can then link key biogeochemical processes which relate to ecosystem services of wetlands in the landscape to these variations in hydroperiod. For example, differences in nitrogen fluxes to the atmosphere, basically through denitrification. And so particularly in the wetter year, in the wettest areas, you get the highest fluxes in the wettest areas, and denitrification basically trails off, is lower and lower as you get into the drier and drier areas. And so you could see that you could build landscape scale estimates of nitrogen flux, and you could basically determine how this might vary as a function of hydrology with an accurate quantification of that based on the LIDAR imagery. In this landscape, key hydrologic drivers are the duration and frequency of flooding and soil saturation at a specified depth, as well as the flow pathways. And it's a landscape where you cannot necessarily infer that water, in two adjacent sites, that water flows from the higher elevation to the lower elevation. A lot of the water movement is subsurface by groundwater pathways, and wetlands that may be adjacent to croplands and uplands are not necessarily connected via groundwater pathways. So in parts of the landscape, nitrate flowing out of these croplands will move through groundwater pathways and maybe be discharged into the stream directly rather than into the wetland. So that bypasses the potential service of denitrification in that wetland. Water quality, I'm not going to spend much time on this, but water quality functions have been related to this TWI, which is a total wetland index. And if you look at, on the top graph here, these are nitrate concentrations. AUP are the agricultural uplands. Here's that alteration gradient, and then surface water. You can see that the nitrate concentrations trail off, as you might expect, but the excess nitrogen produced by denitrification is more of a parabolic, reaching a maximum in the restored wetlands, and part of this is related to those groundwater connections between the uplands and the wetlands. Okay, I'd like to move now to another study in Illinois in the Big Bureau Creek watershed. Big Bureau Creek is a part of the upper Sinachuan watershed. It drains into the Illinois River, which eventually drains into the Mississippi River. It's a tile-drained agricultural landscape, so nitrate losses through tile drainage are particularly important in this landscape. And we got involved in this study, ARS got involved in this study, through the efforts of the Wetlands Initiative, a not-for-profit group located in Chicago. And their objective was basically they wanted to build wetlands or restore wetlands in this landscape in Big Bureau Creek and use the nitrogen, phosphorus removal, and carbon storage to support nutrient credit trading markets with the city of Chicago. Chicago exports a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus in wastewater. It's very expensive to build treatment plants, and so the theory was that these locations in Chicago would pay farmers to remove the nitrogen and phosphorus, allowing them to discharge. And so we got involved and we said, can we apply technologies that we've learned as part of the Conservation Effects Assessment Project into a specific portion of this watershed to determine where the best places are to put wetlands? And this whole idea was cooked up by myself and a fellow who's no longer with the Wetlands Initiative. He was telling me what they wanted to do, and he said, well, one of our big problems is we want to build wetlands, and one of our big problems is we have major sediment issues. And I said, well, in ARS, we know how to site wetlands and riparian zones on the landscape, and we have people who their major, you know, their major research is on controlling sediment movement in watersheds. And so we kind of got together, and we chose this Lime Creek watershed as the pilot study site. And the idea was to analyze using LIDAR and other other analyses to analyze where the best places were in the watershed to build wetlands to get the maximum treatment benefit with some other parameters, which I don't really have time. You'll have to talk to Mark Tomer for all the details on this. And basically the analysis came up with 11 potential wetland locations, 11 wetland sites that could intercept about 30% of the watershed area. And you could reduce the footprint to 25 hectares if you only use the lowest wetland site within each sub-watershed or tributary area. And then this analysis was combined with a modeling effort to basically estimate which of these would, what the nitrogen removal potentials of these various wetlands were. So here in this diagram on the right, as you move from green to red, you see a higher and higher potential for nitrogen removal and with ranges given over here to the right. So here's a wetland that has a great potential to remove nitrogen, and here's one comparatively that has much less potential to remove nitrogen. But the Wetlands Initiative is a group that was interested in building wetlands, but we know that there are a lot of options available to ARS scientists and to farmers for reducing nitrate losses. In addition to wetlands, you can use other conservation practices such as two-stage ditches. You can build wood chip bioreactors. You can use drainage water management techniques, and it's not shown here, but you can use grass waterways as other ways to also reduce nutrient losses to basically improve water quality. And so the analysis was carried one step further, again, using basically expertise developed through the Conservation Effects Assessment Project to say, what if we built these wetlands, but then we put some additional practices on the landscape? If we did that, could we come up with a suite of practices for this particular subwatershed that would provide added benefit in terms of nutrient removal? And that's basically what we did. We came up with this analysis. Actually, I didn't have anything to do with this. Mark Tomer and his colleagues did this. And you can see that in addition to the wetlands and riparian buffers, you've got two-stage ditches, and you've got grassed waterways in some locations for a combined much better effect on water quality than just the wetlands alone. You still get the benefit of the wetlands and the other ecosystem services that they might provide, but you have additional potential for nitrogen removal. Okay, I want to move to this one last example. This is going to move to the Arid West, and this is an initiative that you really have to acknowledge Dave Goodrich and the people that he works with at the Southwest Watershed Research Center in Tucson, Arizona, who have really been important players in this Upper San Pedro Partnership. This partnership is a consortium of 21 agencies, NGOs, private firms, et cetera. It's been around for over 10 years, and they cooperate in the implementation of policies and projects to assist in meeting the water needs of the Upper San Pedro Basin. You can see some of the members there. This Upper San Pedro Basin, in addition to being a microcosm for local, state, and international water and ecological issues, and a good place to do research, says Dave. Here are some of the attributes. It's the location of Fort Huachuca, which employs more than 10,000 people and has an annual payroll of over $1 billion a year. It has an active copper mine in the watershed, and it also represents one of the most ecologically diverse riparian areas, and the first that was congressionally designated as a national riparian conservation area. Groundwater is the predominant source of water in the system, and it's what's It's what sustains wetlands and riparian habitats and associated wildlife species. And so in these types of situations, you know what the scientific answers are. You know what we can do scientifically. But it always gets into the policy questions, and these are mislabeled. Here's the current condition up here. So this is the current condition of riparian vegetation. And if we're going to do, we might be aiming for some alternate here where this is percent of time standing water is present. We increase standing water from less than 60% to between 60 and 95%. And we might see a change in associated species and certainly a change in vegetation, et cetera, ecosystem function. Or we might go even farther and go try to get water there more than 95% of the time. And then you start to see aquatic life and you see a much different habitat. Should we do this through preserving what we have? Should we do it through restoring things that were lost? And if you go for the restoration approach, the cost of this can often be prohibitive, just very, very expensive to do restorations of this nature, particularly in arid landscapes. And so the approach of this group has been basically a number of things, a number of accomplishments. First of all, developing a state-of-the-art groundwater model, quantifying riparian water needs and riparian functional condition classes. And then I think a key here is developing a decision support model that really allows the planners and policymakers in this watershed to analyze these different choices and what the pros and cons of each choice will be. And here's just a slide that sort of talks about this decision support tool. It's fairly complex, a very sophisticated tool. And why I think this is sort of where we're going, the more that I participate in watershed venues, and now we're talking about wetlands, but we're not just talking about wetlands, we're talking about wetlands in broader agricultural landscapes or watersheds. And the more that I go to meetings and hear people talk about watersheds, the more that I hear about this combination of not just the science, but the policy and all the various stakeholders in those watersheds. And this Upper San Pedro partnership is really a model for that type of activity. So let me close by saying, I started out showing you some examples of wetland ecosystem services in individual sites. I think our research has evolved from looking at these site-specific studies to more integrative studies at the watershed or landscape scale, looking at suites of services. I didn't have time to go into a lot of the other details on the Mid-Atlantic Sea Project, for example, and supported by some very sophisticated remote sensing and modeling technology. Wetland ecosystem services can vary as a function of complex watershed and landscape scale features. As an example, in the Mid-Atlantic, these groundwater connections that don't often reflect what you see on the surface, and those have to be considered. The study from Big Bureau Creek, Illinois, illustrates that wetlands might be part of the water quality solution, and they may have other benefits, but there are other things that we can do at the watershed scale to add value to the water quality issue, to provide additional water quality benefits. And then finally, the Upper San Pedro Partnership at the landscape scale, ecosystem services of wetlands and riparian habitats are only part of the issue. Decisions made at this scale require strong partnerships among various stakeholders and state-of-the-art decision support tools to analyze alternate scenarios. Thanks very much. You're welcome.
One question for Mark. In the Chicago project, is there any program to continue to keep track of the maintenance? And because the wetland may by time reduce the efficiency.
We haven't got to the point where farmers are really letting us build any wetlands yet. It's we've done the analysis for this one watershed, and now the watershed is an MRBI watershed, or it's part of a larger MRBI watershed, and they have received they've received MRBI funding, and now it's at the the stage where they're trying to work with farmers to get these practices on the ground, including the wetlands. But with the price of corn going up and the economics being what they are, it's hard to convince farmers to move in that direction.